from Montpelier, Vermont. This is Public Health Radio. Hypertension, otherwise known as high blood pressure, causes more strokes, heart attacks, and more kidney disease than any other treatable health condition. Yet, despite the fact that it's very common, many misunderstandings deter individuals from proper evaluation and treatment, and much more can be done to prevent high blood pressure. Joining us today to discuss the issue is Robert Phillips, a nationally recognized expert in the issue. Then, later in the show, we'll be discussing the campaign to eradicate polio. That effort has encountered a major obstacle in West Africa. Claire Hajaj from UNICEF will be joining us to discuss this setback and the campaign's prospects for the coming months. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Three health-related policies of the Bush administration have attracted attention in the public health community over the last month. For the third straight year, the Bush administration announced that it was refusing to release the $34 million Congress had approved and allocated for the United Nations Population Fund. The administration has alleged for the last 3 years that it will not release the funds until the UN agency discontinues all support for China's family planning program. While China has a history of coercive contraceptive policies, the UN agency does not provide aid to any program or facility which uses coercive methods, and the Bush administration has not contested that point. Critics of the Bush administration policy point out that the UN Population Fund is the lead international agency that provides family planning services to the world's poorest people, and approximately one-third of pregnancies in the poor countries are unplanned and not desired by the woman. Representative Henry Waxman divulged a new policy of President Bush's Department of Health and Human Services. For the first time ever, that federal agency is now requiring the World Health Organization to ask the agency for permission to speak to scientists and must allow Health and Human Services to choose who will respond to requests for information. Representative Waxman commented that for the first time, political appointees will routinely be able to keep the top experts in their fields from responding to World Health Organization requests for guidance on health issues. In a report released on the eve of last month's International AIDS Conference in Bangkok, Thailand, the development organization Oxfam warned that U.S. demands for the free trade agreement to toughen existing intellectual property protection for drugs will hamper Thailand's successful HIV treatment program and undermine future access to affordable medicines. In Thailand, there are nearly 30,000 new HIV infections each year, and access to affordable medicine is a critical component of the anti-HIV strategy. The patent rules in the proposed free trade agreement with Thailand would close down the option of accessing such inexpensive generic medicines in the future. Writing in last month's New York Times, Nobel Prize laureate Joseph Stiglitz also castigated the Bush administration's policy on HIV drugs. He wrote that President Bush's policy was puzzling and hypocritical because only last year he had pledged $15 billion to aid the effort to combat the global HIV epidemic, but what he gave with one hand, he is taking away with the other. To learn more about Oxfam's concerns, the web address is oxfam.org. Finally, the British Medical Journal reports that more than 20 million people are homeless and 300 have died from drowning, snake bite, and disease in the worst monsoon flooding to hit Bangladesh in many years. The United Nations warned of a humanitarian crisis, And the Red Cross launched an emergency appeal as two-thirds of the country and almost half of the capital city, Dakar, were flooded. Local relief officials warned that stagnant floodwater polluted with raw sewage could lead to epidemics of waterborne diseases, such as dysentery, typhoid, and cholera, and that a lack of access to clean water had already caused outbreaks of diarrhea. 3,500 mobile medical teams have been deployed across the country in response. Coming up next, we'll look at high blood pressure and the impacts it has on stroke, heart disease, and kidney disease. And then later in the show, a look at the current effort of UNICEF and the World Health Organization to eradicate polio. Stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. While it generates less attention than HIV, cancer, or diabetes, high blood pressure ranks with arthritis as one of the two most common chronic health problems. But unlike arthritis, high blood pressure has major implications if it's left untreated. High blood pressure is the leading cause of strokes, heart attacks, and kidney disease. And after quitting smoking, lowering one's blood pressure is the most important action an individual can take to improve one's health. Joining us today to discuss high blood pressure is Robert Phillips. Dr. Phillips is president of the Eastern U.S. Division of the American Society of Hypertension, associate editor of the Archives of Internal Medicine, and throughout his career has focused his research effort on the study of high blood pressure. He is on the faculty of the NYU School of Medicine in New York and treats patients at Lenox Hill Hospital. Robert Phillips, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Hi, thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Why don't we start out by clarifying our definitions? Are the terms high blood pressure and hypertension basically the same thing? And how high does blood pressure have to be considered elevated? Does that change with age?
You're correct that high blood pressure and hypertension are the same. And probably we should be calling it high blood pressure, because when people hear the word hypertension, they think that it's because they're tense that blood pressure is elevated, and that's not true. That's rarely a cause, actually. And then in response to your question about when do you have to start worrying about blood pressure elevation, the truth is that treatment still starts when the blood pressure is greater than 140 over 90. But we know that people have more complications from high blood pressure if their blood pressure starts to be greater than around 120 over 80.
And do we change that definition as people age?
Not really. You know, it's a pretty constant definition throughout adult life.
So by that definition, how many people, or would say what percentage of adults in the U.S. have high blood pressure?
Right now, probably around one-third of adults, you know, have high blood pressure.
And that becomes more common with age?
Yes. The likelihood of developing high blood pressure throughout one's life is close to around 80-85% if you get to live long enough. So if you're lucky to live until you're into your 80s, the likelihood of you having hypertension is very high.
It's common knowledge that blood pressure readings consist of two numbers, the upper one being the systolic and the lower number the diastolic blood pressure. And I was wondering if you could tell us about the current understanding of which of the two is more important.
Yes, you're correct. Right now, actually, we're starting to focus more on the systolic blood pressure. That's the top number. Prior to around 5 years ago, the focus had been on the diastolic blood pressure, and that's because when concerns started about the effects of high blood pressure, we were looking at middle-aged men. And up until around the age of 50, the diastolic blood pressure still actually is a really important number. But after around age 50, 55, the number that predicts whether you're going to have a stroke or a heart attack or problems with your blood vessels because of high blood pressure or kidney problems is really the systolic blood pressure. So actually in my practice, I'm almost always focusing now just on the systolic blood pressure. And I don't even tell patients many times what their diastolic blood pressure is because it's really not that important and it doesn't really affect the treatment. The number now that we really understand is the one that has to get down is the systolic blood pressure.
So what are the risks of high blood pressure? But what kinds of concerns develop that would be palpable that patients would be concerned
sure.
about?
Sure. I mean, if you look at actually worldwide and even nationwide of the factors that lead to heart disease, kidney disease, stroke, actually high blood pressure is the most important risk factor for that. So what you get from blood pressure that's not controlled is an increased risk and chance of having a stroke, having a heart attack, having heart failure, having kidney disease, and having vessel disease, peripheral vascular disease.
Do these risks generally parallel the degree of high blood pressure? In other words, if you're at 150 over 100, is your risk less than if it were 160 over 110, for instance?
Yeah, the risk. Yeah, that's exactly right, is that one of the simple to understand concepts about high blood pressure, which you've just pointed out, is that the higher the number, the greater your risk. And the good news is, and I'm sure we'll get to this when we talk about treatment, the lower your number, the lower your risk. So it's one of those things that you can easily move about.
Now, the risks you mentioned are the most common ones. We talk about kidney disease, heart failure, and vascular disease.
And stroke.
And stroke.
Right.
And those, as I understand them, are all long-term risks. The longer your blood pressure, the higher your blood pressure is, the longer it is, the more likely those are to occur. Can you just talk for just briefly about short-term risks? For example, I've had many patients, I've worked to a fair amount with substance abuse, and I've had patients who don't really normally have high blood pressure, but especially with the use of cocaine,
right,
may develop very high blood pressure. And are there any short-term risks that can happen right away if blood pressure is very high?
Sure. I mean, that's what's called a hypertensive emergency. And that occurs when the blood pressure rises very, very fast to high levels. So if somebody's usual blood pressure is somewhere around 150 over 80, and all of a sudden it goes to 200 over 130, then the blood vessels are going to get damaged, and you have then more chance of having a renal disease or a stroke. But that's actually very rare, and the chances of that happening are very, very small now. That used to be a problem up until around the late 80s, but now with really good treatment, the fact that most people who have hypertension, the majority of people know about it and are getting some treatment, that's really actually been diminished.
So when we think of symptoms resulting from high blood pressure, if you had heart failure, you would be short of breath.
Right.
If you had a stroke, you
right.
would be unable to move, perhaps unable to move one side of your body. But I'd like to talk about symptoms of high blood pressure itself just for a second. Some patients, on the one hand, say they can tell
mm-hmm.
they have high blood pressure.
Right.
And other people are reluctant to start on treatment because they say, I feel perfectly fine. Why do you want to give me medicines?
Right.
So how do you deal with the issue of symptoms? Can people tell they have high blood pressure?
It's very rare that people can tell it. I have an occasional patient, I'd say maybe 2 out of 100, who are able to say that a symptom which they have, they can correlate with an elevation of blood pressure. But people with elevated blood pressure do tend to have a slightly increased incidence of headaches in general. Occasionally people can get it. But usually, it's called a silent killer. And one of the reasons why people, as you say, are reluctant to go on medication is they don't feel anything's wrong with them. So in many ways, this is a leap of faith, saying to people, well, you know, we don't have the symptom, but we know from following people for 40, 50 years and from thousands of studies that have been done that if your blood pressure is elevated, you have a greater risk of having a stroke. So the best thing for you to do is to take some medication or to change your lifestyle, exercise more, eat better diet to get your blood pressure down. But sometimes it's a hard sell. It is.
Now, on many occasions when I'm treating patients, a patient will say to me something like, well, that blood pressure may be high for most people, but that high reading's normal for me. My body's used to it. It's not a problem. Uh-huh. How do you respond to a patient who says that to you?
Well, I'm always amazed that people can say that because I don't know what evidence they have that enables them to say it's okay for them. I mean, I'm a scientist as well as being a physician, so I look at data all the time, and that it's really not a correct statement to say that that you're just because you feel you're different from other people that you are. You have to be able to prove it. And in most of the cases, they won't be able to show you any evidence for that other than that's their belief. So, I show them the data and I say, well, I don't think you really are different than anybody else who happens to have a blood pressure of let's say they're 170. I mean, the likelihood of you having a stroke with a blood pressure of 170 is, 2 to 3 times greater than somebody who's at 150. So that's maybe you'll be lucky, maybe you're right, but, why do you want to take that kind of chance?
Now, we just, only a few months ago on Public Health Radio, Dr. Rizza from the American Diabetes Association talked about diabetes. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we discussed was the existence, in the case of diabetes, of a test. It's called hemoglobin A1C. You obviously know about it. But the concept is that blood sugar changes hour to hour, and so there's a blood test that tries to give a sense of what the average blood sugar is
right.
over a 3-month period.
Right.
In the case of high blood pressure, how do you really know whether a patient's blood pressure may be higher right in front of you in the office, and how do you get a sense of what their blood pressures are for most of the rest of their lives when they're not right there in front of you?
Right. That's a really good question. And in our practice, we encourage several things. One is that if somebody's blood pressure comes into our office and they are clearly elevated, and then they have evidence of having the problems we're talking about, from high blood pressure, if the heart is enlarged, or if the kidneys have some dysfunction, or if you can demonstrate evidence of vessel disease, then we always go ahead and start treatment. If people come in and their pressure is elevated in the office, but they tell us that their pressure, either in a pharmacy or at home or in another physician's office, is low or normal, then we either do one of two things. One is we say, well, take your blood pressure at home often and let's see what it is there. Or actually, we think the simplest thing to do is to do a technique called ambulatory blood pressure monitoring, where you put a cuff on the person's arm, it gets attached to a little computer that they wear on their waist, and then every 15 to 20 minutes, we take blood pressure throughout the day and also through the night. And that actually is a very accurate and reproducible way of determining whether somebody really has high blood pressure or not. Because I'm sure people have heard of the term white coat hypertension, and probably around 30% of people who seem to have high blood pressure in the office are actually normal outside the office. And it's my opinion and the prevailing opinion that they don't need to be treated.
Do you think patients with high blood pressure should buy a blood pressure cuff and monitor their blood pressure at home?
I think it's very helpful. I don't think it's I only do it actually early on if I'm not really sure if the person's blood pressure is really elevated or not. And then sometimes to follow changes in medication. And then I'd also say is that I think it's also important if you're doing that to bring in the monitor to your health provider so that they can calibrate it to make sure that the machine is accurately reflecting what the true pressures are.
Now let's turn for a moment to the treatment of high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors generally think of the treatment in two categories, changes in what we call lifestyle and then medical treatment.
Right.
Tell us about both of these, and are there any patients for whom you don't recommend changes in lifestyle?
Well, No, there really isn't anybody who I don't recommend changing a lifestyle, although lifestyle changes are difficult.
Which ones do you recommend?
So what I recommend to people are several things. One is I always recommend to people that to try to get more exercise in their life and to try to walk as much as possible. And to if they can do aerobic exercise, that's terrific, and find a sport that they think is fun. I recommend to people that they try to include more fruits and vegetables in their diet, because that's something which I think people, you know, can do, and there's really good evidence that if you do that, you'll get a significant drop in blood pressure of, you know, of 10, you know, some up to 10 millimeters of mercury. So that's pretty big. And I also do recommend to people that they watch the salt in their diet, and if they, you know, to get rid of the salt shaker at home, to get institute more different types of spices into their diet, and when they're, if they go out to eat, to try to eat low salt as much as they can. And, you know, weight reduction is very hard. So although I recommend that to people, most people fail, and it's frustrating. And then the other issue is around alcohol consumption, is to have moderate alcohol consumption. So equivalent to one drink a day for women, two drinks a day for men. That actually has been shown to be associated with lower blood pressure. But if you drink more than that, then the pressures go up.
The other part of treatment, if lifestyle changes don't succeed, it would be considered appropriate medical care to then start patients on medical treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So in the last several years, there's been the other big area of controversy in the medical field about which drugs are the best ones to use for high blood pressure.
Right.
I guess the controversy basically goes, if two different drugs can produce the same degree of blood pressure reduction,
right,
might one of them nonetheless actually be better and produce better long-term outcomes?
Right.
Or is the important thing just getting the blood pressure down? So I just wonder if you could address that.
Okay. So let me start with this second point you mentioned. I think that the most important issue is to get the blood pressure down. I think that's what the bulk of all the studies have shown, is that irrespective of what drug you're on, the most important thing is your blood pressure is lower. And that's for people who have uncomplicated high blood pressure. So they don't have kidney disease associated with their high blood pressure. They don't have heart failure associated with their high blood pressure. They haven't had a stroke. So in that group of people, who represent actually the majority of people, so because most people just have an elevation of blood pressure, which is detected either by themselves or by a healthcare provider, and they don't have anything else wrong with them. In that group of people, the overwhelming analysis of the data would be to say, just get the blood pressure down. It doesn't really matter how you do it. So that would say then, so you can then start with diuretic therapy, which I think is a good idea in most people, low-dose diuretic therapy, and then add on another agent to get the blood pressure lower if you need to do that. Or you could start with, you know, depending on, sometimes physician has some preference or the patient has some preference, and there are different classes of drugs that you can go on. Now, then, for people, though, who have other problems, such as heart failure or kidney disease, there may be then other drugs which are more specific to that would also promote healing, like of the kidney, or preventing it from getting damaged further. So you might want to be on another particular type of blood pressure medication.
So in other words, in some situations, a certain medication can have actually two separate benefits.
Exactly.
To a patient. Now, many of my patients are reluctant to take blood pressure medicines because they're convinced that every medication will be fraught with adverse side effects.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, I can't even convince patients with high blood pressure to even start on treatment. How do you approach patients like that who are concerned about adverse side effects?
There are some side effects which are associated with just about any drug. But it turns out that with the modern antihypertensive drugs that we have now, the drugs that treat high blood pressure, the side effects really are fairly minimal. With low-dose diuretic therapy, people really don't get that much increased urination. It happens in the beginning, it goes away. People used to be concerned about getting potassium losses. That's very rare. With the converting enzyme inhibitors that we have available, some occasional person gets a cough, around 10%, so you can stop it. Angiotensin II receptor blockers, a new big class of drugs, almost symptom-free, okay? And then calcium channel blockers, another big class. Sometimes people get some swelling of the legs. That's the big concern they have. But these are all things which occur only at the most, usually maybe 5% of the time, 10% of the time, and the drug can be stopped. And we have many other medications, then you can go on. If you get a side effect on one, well, you can try a different class. And so it's not that I'm not sympathetic towards the issue of side effect, but I don't think it's something that should limit then getting the benefit of having a prevention of a stroke, because that's a real bad side effect. You know, so, you know, and I'm very straightforward with people, and I show them, actually, I say, well, you know, what the consequences are of stroke, and I'll act out, like, what it's like to have, you know, not be able to speak, or what it's not be able to move your leg, or, you know, if people are concerned about the fact that they might have sexual dysfunction, let's say, like, with antihypertensive medication, well, I'll point out to them that once they've had a stroke, or heart failure, or kidney disease, then it's, you know, then to have, be able to perform sexually is really decreased. And you can't change that. So I'm fairly, you know, I spend, you know, time trying to convince people that it's the best thing to do.
And none of the side effects, if there were any from high blood pressure medicine, would it really ever be permanent?
Well, I mean, it's like an occasional situation, very, very rare. You know, you could get one that could be it could be really damaging. But that is so infrequent, you know, that, you know, so like I've done nearly 100 clinical trials. I've had thousands of patients in studies of different types of medications, new medications, you know, and I can, you know, count on, and I'm involved in studies all over the country. You know, it's rare that somebody gets something from a high blood pressure medication, which is life-threatening, really rare.
Now, if someone needs, say someone with fairly resistant high blood pressure needs four medications to get their blood pressure down to, say, 130 over 85.
Right.
Is their risk of complications from high blood pressure actually as low as someone else whose blood pressure is about 130 over 85 without medicine?
No.
Do these medicines really work?
Yeah, sure. The medicines definitely work. They don't bring down your risk to as if you happen to have just been living with a blood pressure of 130 over 85. We don't quite understand why that is. But it's probably because there's some underlying, you know, problem we know in the blood vessels that we can't completely fix. But the risks are reduced dramatically, you know, by having blood pressure drop, let's say, from 170 over, you know, 90, or if you're an older person, let's say 170 over 80, because usually the diastolic tends to be lower in older people, down to, you know, 140 to 150. I mean, your risks of getting a heart attack or stroke are dropped in half.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Today, our guest has been Robert Phillips, an expert in the field of high blood pressure. So far, we've been discussing the diagnosis and treatment of high blood pressure. And after the break, we'll be looking at individual and public policy actions that might lessen the great burden of death and disability that high blood pressure currently brings about. Then, later in the show, we'll feature a status report on the global effort to eradicate polio. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Today we've been looking at high blood pressure, and our guest has been Robert Phillips, the associate editor of the Archives of Internal Medicine, and a researcher and expert in the treatment of high blood pressure. Now back to the interview. So far today, we've been talking about high blood pressure and what it is and what its long-term risks are, and also a good deal about the treatment of high blood pressure as individuals may confront it. And I'd like now to broaden our discussion into the area of public policy and what government or policymakers, perhaps even in the private sector, might be able to do to either prevent high blood pressure or maybe facilitate its treatment. And maybe we could start out, first of all, by talking about screening. And for listeners who aren't familiar with the term, that basically means looking to identify a disease condition, maybe that has no symptoms in a population that is unaware of whether the problem affects them. And as you pointed out earlier in this interview, most people who have high blood pressure can't really tell that. They can't feel it. So I'd like to ask you, should people who have no personal or family history of high blood pressure be checked for it on, say, on a routine basis? Do you believe in screening for high blood pressure?
Yes, and the reason is exactly what you point out, is that high blood pressure is one of those conditions which has serious consequences, but you do not have a symptom prior to having the serious consequence. So it's very important that screening gets taken care of in two types of ways. One is that when you go to a physician, so let's say many women go to a gynecologist for pap smears or routine examinations, that at those visits blood pressure gets taken so that the physician, the general physician taking care of the patient, can have information about that. And then many times communities will establish screening on a regular basis, either through the fire department or through community hospitals. And I think it's very important that patients avail themselves of that so that they can see what their blood pressure is during routine types of daily activities outside of the office.
So how often would you want to see screening occur, and does it vary by age or race?
Yeah, I think actually once a year you should have your blood pressure checked. I think that's very important. I don't think it really matters that much. I mean, African Americans should pay a little more attention to their blood pressure and getting it checked more often, because they get more consequences from even moderate or mild elevations in blood pressure. And then as people age, blood pressure tends to go up. But still, if you get it done on a regular yearly basis, I think 6 months maybe at the max, then you'll get a good idea of where pressure is going, because it's rare that you get a major just shoot up in pressure. Usually there's a gradual rise that occurs.
Now let's turn now to the prevention of high blood pressure. In the U.S., we seem to see a rather gradual or relentless rise in systolic blood pressure, that's the upper number, as people age. And I guess I wanted to ask, is that an inevitable consequence of aging, or can that be prevented? And what about high blood pressure in younger groups? Can you prevent high blood pressure through perhaps lifestyle change?
We now have a fair amount of data now to say that you can prevent the rises in blood pressure through a series of initiatives that patients, or not, I don't even call them patients because they won't become patients, that individuals can take for themselves. And that is to try to maintain a healthy lifestyle, keeping weight down in ideal weight ranges, incorporating exercise into your daily routine. I mean, I think this whole idea now of 10,000 steps a day is terrific. And then moderating alcohol consumption and decreasing the amount of salt that you take into the diet.
And this would be true for various age groups, or all age groups?
Absolutely. And we even have good evidence that the changes that occur with aging are not inevitable. That if we take people and put them into a study where they get moderate types of exercise, you can improve blood vessel function, and then you can heal the blood vessels and then return people to lower levels of blood pressure.
In order to facilitate improvements in diet and to encourage people to exercise, government institutions, especially local governments, potentially could change, for example, that could change zoning laws to prevent the installment of fast food restaurants near playgrounds or schools, or decrease the number of McDonald's. These types of
types of zoning interventions were proposed in the September issue of the American Journal of Public Health last year, really talking about urban planning and local planning to encourage healthy lifestyle. And I guess I was wondering if doing that and developing pleasant recreational places like bicycle paths and parks where walking or running or bicycling would be encouraged, if that type of policy would strike you as something that might help to prevent high blood pressure.
Well, I think that the more we can do to create an environment for easy access for people to a healthy lifestyle, the better you can do. And there are seniors groups that have organized walking. I think that's terrific. Many senior centers do that, and you can see older people walking in the community. And if we can provide safe ways to do that, I think that's wonderful.
You pointed out the importance of raising public awareness of high blood pressure and discuss the importance of having regular monitoring and modification of treatment. We got into that in detail earlier. But I really face another problem, even among patients who already have an awareness that they have high blood pressure. And I would say that in the last few years, the issue of the type of health insurance policies has started to have a very major impact, most especially in the treatment of high blood pressure, because of the fact that it's really asymptomatic. People can have blood pressures of 160 over 100, and they don't know. They mm-hmm. can't feel that. What's happening here in Vermont in our health insurance market is that we now have a real major advance in the number of people who have insurance policies that have high deductibles. And I'll just explain for listeners, in these types of health insurance policies, patients basically pay the first $4,000 or so, first $4,000 out of pocket. Sometimes they have something called a medical savings account, which the Bush administration and also our governor here in Vermont has been promoting. But whether or not they have that, they're still paying the first $4,000 out of pocket. And if they're not wealthy, they feel that. And after they come to $4,000 or $5,000, then a catastrophic insurance policy takes over and pays everything. But what's going on for these people is they're not getting to that catastrophe most of the time, the vast majority of people, and they're having a lot of trouble coming in with the frequency we may need to get their blood pressure down, particularly people who have the higher level of blood pressure readings where they may need... You can comment on how safe it is to just throw four medicines at a patient all at once because you know they probably are going to get there, because I'm not been taught that that's safe to do, and instead I feel a need to do this in a slow or supervised, careful manner. So these people are negotiating with me about delaying follow-up visits. Can they do without visits checking for side effects? Can they do without measuring potassium levels when I start certain medications? And I guess I was wondering what your thoughts are on that issue.
Well, first of all, I think $4,000 is a lot for anybody, and I think that it would inhibit most people, even the wealthy, from going for health care if they had to meet a $4,000 deductible. So I think that will, clearly I can understand how that has a chilling effect on patients' desire to get a regular follow-up. But regular follow-up is important for hypertension, as you point out, because although in general the medications are relatively side effect-free, there are side effects that do occur.
Do you think that having access to insurance with a system that would cover everyone would improve our outcomes here in the U.S. from high blood pressure?
I think there's no question about that. I think that there's clear evidence from many different types of sources, and especially on this type of chronic disease, an asymptomatic type of disease, which hypertension is that by limiting access, you wind up down the road with more severe problems because there's been inadequate attention paid to the early stages of the disease. Health maintenance organizations understand that, because even though they are sometimes going in and out of the care of the patient in terms of whether they're in their plan or not, they understand that it's better to provide preventive care even for the 2 or 3 years that the patient is in their program, because it leads to, in the case of hypertension, less stroke and less heart attacks. So if you extrapolate that out, then clearly one would say that for the general population, universal health care would almost certainly reduce the complications from a disease like hypertension.
Well, Robert Phillips, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
It's been a pleasure.
The National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, one of the divisions of the National Institutes of Health, has an especially helpful website on high blood pressure. Their web address is nhlbi.nih.gov. A link to this website will be available at the Public Health Radio website, which is publichealthradio.org. Coming up next, a look at the successes and obstacles to the worldwide effort to eradicate polio. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. When Jonas Salk announced the development of an effective vaccine against polio in 1954, the world breathed a sigh of relief. Parents could now prevent their children from suffering from the paralyzing infection, which had exacted such a toll on millions over the previous century, most famously Franklin Roosevelt. Within just a few years, virtually every American child was immunized, and the disease was quickly eradicated in the United States, along with the other wealthy countries. But despite the availability of an effective vaccine, poverty and war have served as major obstacles to eradicating the disease in the poorer countries. But there has been progress. At the beginning of this year, only 6 countries still had cases, and the World Health Organization announced the goal of eradicating the disease by the end of 2004. Unfortunately, this has proved to be a more daunting task than previously expected, and the goal may not be met. Joining us today to provide an update on polio is Claire Hajjaj. Ms. Hajjaj is the spokesperson for UNICEF's polio eradication campaign. In the past, she has worked for the BBC and their International Affairs Bureau, and also for the International Red Cross. She has traveled widely in Africa and Asia in her work on the polio eradication effort. Claire Hajjaj, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you very much.
Before we get into the recent events occurring in Africa, I was wondering if you could just briefly describe polio virus and the types of infections it can cause.
Well, polio is a really very cruel disease. It's a disease of the nervous system. It's transmitted through the what they call the oral fecal route, basically through contaminated water. It can appear to be flu, give flu-like symptoms, but within hours can lead to irreparable, irreversible paralysis, and in some cases, death when the breathing mechanism is shut down because of nervous system damage.
Obviously, in the United States, we're most familiar with polio as causing paralysis, usually, especially in the legs, mm-hmm. making it impossible to walk for the rest of one's life. And Franklin Roosevelt was one of the most prominent examples. So it's obviously, as you said, a pretty horrible disease. But unlike some of the other fairly horrible diseases you hear about, like malaria, tuberculosis, or HIV, there's an international campaign to eradicate polio. And I was wondering if you could talk about the special features of polio that makes this even feasible.
Well, there have been several eradication efforts with different diseases, and polio, I think, is on quite a select list of diseases that can be eradicated. I think the primary two big reasons why polio can be eradicated: one, there's no animal reservoir for polio. It only lives in people, and it can't survive indefinitely on the outside. And two, there's a vaccine that works against polio, immunizes children. You put those two together, and you have a situation where if you immunize enough children, you drive the virus out, give it nowhere to hide, you can eradicate the disease. And we've seen this done very effectively across, you know, vast tracts of the world. At the moment, there are, you know, Europe and the Americas and the Western Pacific region are now polio-free.
The World Health Organization had, therefore, based on what you've just said, had set the goal of eradicating polio by the end of next year. But now that hope seems threatened, and I was wondering if you could tell us about what's occurred.
Okay, let me just briefly say that the World Health Organization, UNICEF, Rotary International, and CDC are part of an alliance, spearheading partners of the Global Polio Eradication Initiative, and that initiative was born, really born off the back of Rotary International in the mid-90s. Rotarians were raising money to immunize children against polio, and they saw the extraordinary results that you can get when you do immunize children. The disease can basically vanish out of communities quite fast. They took the dream of a polio-free world for all children to the World Health Assembly, and in 1988, the World Health Assembly voted all the nations of the world to eradicate this disease. Since then, WHO, Rotary, UNICEF, and CDC have been working hand in hand with other partners to make sure that that dream becomes a reality. Now, on the 15th of January of this year, governments of the remaining six endemic countries got together and recognized a few basic things: that we have achieved incredible results against polio, 99% slashed incidence of polio cases from 350,000 every year to just around, I think, 780 last year, that there are six endemic countries, the lowest ever number of countries, and given the confined nature of the virus at that time, it looked entirely feasible to stop polio by the end of 2004. And so these governments decided between them that that would be the goal and the objective. This is not an objective of the UN. It's not an objective of anything other than national governments. They know that they can do this job. So they signed the Geneva Declaration to say 2004 would be the last year of polio on Earth. Since then, we've had some great news and some setbacks, I think, as you probably know. The great news is that polio in Asia, where three of the endemic countries are, India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, is at its lowest transmission rate ever. I mean, almost close to zero transmission in those countries, really low. When you consider the population density and the situation, particularly in Afghanistan, you know what kind of achievement that really is. However, on the other side of the world, in Africa, there are very few polio reservoirs left, and the main one is in Kano State in northern Nigeria. That's the big one there, and Kano State has unfortunately not been immunizing its children since August 2003 because of a local dispute there about the use of oral polio vaccine and the motives of the campaign. So when you have children in a reservoir area not being immunized against the disease, and you have children surrounding that area who have fairly low rates of routine immunization and aren't particularly strong in themselves, their immune systems can often be quite weak because of malnutrition, you have the perfect conditions for a virus to spread, and indeed it has spread over Africa.
In the website of UNICEF, they were saying that there's now five times more cases of polio in Western Africa this year compared to the previous year. Is that the case?
Yeah, transmission rates have really leapt up. And I think we need to put that into perspective and say that transmission rates last year were incredibly low, the lowest ever. So what we're seeing is a virus that looks like it's speeding up rather than a virus that looks like it's slowing down. And it's very frightening news for everybody who's been involved in the eradication campaign, because we know that it's a doable job. Or at the same time, what we have this year is, for example, just last week in Nigeria, I think 2 weeks ago, we confirmed 60 cases of polio. That's incredibly high transmission rates, and we're in the low season for polio transmission. So that means that transmission is only going to increase as we go into the wet and rainy season, where children are more at risk of infection and the virus is going to stay alive for longer and travel further.
There was concern apparently among the leaders in the Kano state in northern Nigeria, where we've had the most cases in the last year or two. What was the cause of their concern, and how was it allayed?
There were some concerns that were raised by local community activists in northern Nigeria pulling stuff off the internet that basically alleged all kinds of hidden motives for the polio eradication campaign, that it was a population control exercise, that the vaccine was in some way harmful, contained contaminants, was designed to sterilize children. And these allegations are not new, and they're not unique to polio either. I mean, allegations have been made by about a number of immunization campaigns over the years. And they often crop up not where people are, you know, have ready access to a whole load of reliable information, but where communities are disempowered, where there are problems between federal and state governments, where there are problems between communities and local governments, where there are marginalized poor and people who just don't have access to basic health in one way or another. So we began to see incidents of these rumors in northern Nigeria, and before we knew it, right, these rumors were being investigated by the local authorities, and the vaccine was being tested, and immunization was halted during this process.
So now those fears have been allayed, and has the campaign restarted in those areas?
Those fears have been allayed. I mean, it took a long time, but the government and the Kano state governor and his authorities tested the vaccine, laid out conditions for re-beginning immunization activities, and all of those conditions have been met, and the Nigerian authorities themselves have said, look, this vaccine is safe. So what we're now waiting for eagerly is a firm date for the resumption of activities in Kano, because the activities haven't started yet. And the reason that this is so concerning, not just to us, but to all Africans, I think, is that when you think about 60 cases of polio in Nigeria in 1 week, you start to see what even a delay of a week can do to children in the region. And the virus is spreading, and we are entering high season. It's an absolutely critical time. And immunization needs to happen in Kano as soon as possible, because that is the reservoir that's keeping the virus, fueling the virus right now.
Another factor that would seem to me to get in the way of immunization campaigns would be military conflict. And Africa certainly had its share. And I was wondering if all the conflicts in Central Africa, Eastern Congo, have had an impact, and also the conflict more recently that's gone on in the Sudan.
For sure, conflict really does affect access to children, and polio eradication is a campaign that needs to get the vaccine to every single child. It takes the vaccine house to house. So in situations where you have a lot of political instability and civil conflict, that's going to affect the number of children that you can reach. One of the great things about the polio eradication campaign, and I think one of the things that makes it such an extraordinary public health effort that moved beyond public health, is that it's actually brought days of tranquility to conflict zones. People have been able to negotiate ceasefires between warring groups and warring factions to allow the vaccinators to pass. And it's been really extraordinary to see the effectiveness of that in places like Sierra Leone, in Angola, in Somalia, where local militias actually took the vaccine themselves and handed vaccine carriers off between militias so that tribes in different areas controlled by different groups could be immunized. It's an extraordinary thing to watch that happen, and to know that these in places where conflict has seemed relentless and unstoppable, that it has actually been stopped, even albeit temporarily, for the good of children. And in some parts of the world, like in Sierra Leone, days of tranquility and polio ceasefires actually brought warring factions around the table to negotiate ceasefires for the first time. And it's arguable that contributed to the peace process. So it's something that has been an extraordinary byproduct of this public health campaign.
The occurrence of cases of polio in distant places like Nigeria or Sudan can seem to be something listeners here in the U.S., where most of the people are able to tune into this show, something that people here may have trouble relating to. So I wanted to try to compare the experience of a child, or an adult for that matter, with a major physical disability, such as paralysis of both your legs, such a person who lives in Nigeria compared to what their experience might be in the U.S. I mean, here for 15 years now, we've had the Americans with Disability Act, we're used to having buildings constructed to accommodate people with wheelchairs. We have ramps at intersections, elevators. And I guess I would like to describe what the prospects are for a 5-year-old child in Africa who develops paralysis of the lower extremities.
The prospect for children paralyzed by polio in Africa is a pretty bleak one, has to be said. And we have to bear in mind the context. I mean, when we live in the States or in the UK and Europe, there's a hospital in every corner. There are rehabilitation facilities. You've got a great social services system and a lot of very understanding people around and about the place. This is just a long way from what most African children have to grow up with. Many of them will never have seen any other form of health service. They may not be immunized against other diseases. They will already probably be weak and malnourished. They will not be able to marry. They will not be able to support their families. They will not be able to participate in life in any meaningful way. And that's not true of all of them, but we're talking about the majority of them. They will be reduced to begging to earn their keep. Their lives are going to be essentially taken away from them, and their ability to contribute to their communities and to, you know, their ability to bring Africa into a better place financially, economically, in terms of public health, in terms of good governance. All of these things they're not going to be able to participate in. It's just a tragic waste of potential in so many ways, and avoidable and unnecessary, because of course there is a vaccine that will protect these children. Yeah, it's a pretty bleak prospect.
So we have an immunization campaign going, and the U.S. is obviously one of many governments that is supporting it, at least via the actions of the CDC. But what would you like to see interested listeners do to try to improve the situation there?
What we really need, the two things that we really need at the moment, that the campaign really needs, funds, always, the spread of polio in Africa because of non-immunization in Kano's state is requiring us to double our immunization response, the scale of it. We're going to try and reach 74 million children across Africa later on this year in synchronized campaigns across 22 countries, and that's going to cost a significant amount of money. We need $25 million by August that we hadn't planned for. Otherwise, more children are going to be paralyzed by this disease.
So you would like to see listeners donate to UNICEF?
Donate to the campaign, lobby their congressman. I think that's really important. Certainly, people can contribute, and personal contributions are always welcome through UNICEF, through Rotary International, any of these things. But obviously, government contributions are vastly important, and it's important. We've had incredibly supportive governments, particularly the US. We need that support to continue, and they need to know that it matters to the American people.
Well, Claire Hajaj, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Since the recording of this interview 3 weeks ago, the government of the Kano State in Nigeria, the epicenter of the current epidemic, has agreed to allow the resumption of polio vaccination. To learn more about the polio eradication campaign, as well as the other projects UNICEF works on, the website is unicef.org. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.